May it please the court, Ms. Rittman. This is an attorney discipline case wherein respondent has violated multiple rules of professional conduct in his capacity as a personal representative for the estate of Ethel Hall. He violated his duty to the profession, to the court, and to his client by taking a personal representative fee without proper court authorization. In so doing, he failed to safekeep property in violation of Rule 4-1.15, submitted false or incomplete information to the probate court in the final settlement in violation of Rule 4-3.3, disobeyed an obligation under the rules of the court by taking a fee prior to final settlement contrary to the probate court's order in violation of Rule 4-3.4C, and engaged in conduct involving deceit in violation of Rule 4-8.4C. Respondent would have this court believe that the case boils down to a series of unfortunate mistakes. The respondent was a creature of habit and tradition who chose to follow his father's advice and his law firm's practices rather than the orders of the probate judge, statutory mandates, and the rules of professional conduct. Respondent alternatively suggests that the court should dismiss the case, issue an unavailable admonition, or at most reprimand him. He concludes that a suspension would be completely excessive. The panel that heard the case found each of the violations charged and recommended to this court the respondent be indefinitely suspended with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 6 months. Informant concurs in that recommendation. This was a supervised estate under the jurisdiction of probate judge R. Paul Beard. On February 17, respondent filed a motion for approval of partial payment of his personal representative fees in the amount of $30,070. The next day, February 18, 2015, Judge Beard denied the motion because it sought fees in excess of the statutory amount and because the court stated that permitting early payments of partial fees would eliminate the incentive to close the estate. That same day, respondent filed a more detailed statement or more detailed amended motion for partial payment of fees. And significantly, in that amended motion for fees, he cited the very statutory section, section 453.153 of the probate code, that respondent now claims before this court that he did not need to follow when he later took a fee without court authorization. The court entered a second order citing the statute again, 453.153, and authorized respondent to pay himself $15,000, which was to be deducted from the final calculation of fees at the close of the estate. Respondent paid himself that $15,000. The clear import of Judge Beard's two orders in February 2015, as well as his testimony at the DHP hearing, was that any additional personal representative fees would only be authorized upon court order at the final settlement of the estate. Nevertheless, 4 months later, on June 25, 2015, in direct contravention of Judge Beard's February order, respondent wrote himself a check from the estate in the amount of $15,466 and deposited that money into his law firm operating account. Respondent did not seek permission from the court for the payment, even though he testified that it was his practice to file an application and obtain a court order before paying himself fees in such cases. In addition, the probate statute, as indicated, 453.153.6, required that respondent's compensation as personal representative was only allowable upon application to the court. In this regard, neither the final settlement nor a motion to approve a final settlement and request for compensation had been filed in June 2015. Stated another way, that money belonged to the estate until the court ordered otherwise, and respondent failed to safekeep the estate's funds by taking an unauthorized payment to himself, fee to himself. On September 1, 2015, respondent filed a petition for approval of final settlement and order of distribution. Between June 25, 2015, when he took that payment, and September 1, when he filed his petition for approval of a final settlement, he made no attempt to contact Judge Beard to explain the June 25th payment. He failed to notify Judge Beard of that payment, nor seek court approval for the unauthorized payment. In addition, the final settlement on September 1 did not list the June 2015 payment that he had made to himself.
Counsel, can I clarify? It did not list it, but there's no suggestion he was trying to get $45,000, that he was no one's accused him of stealing.
Absolutely not,
okay.
Judge Smith. The $30,000 would have been the amount due based on the size of the estate, $1,280,000.
Right. And that's what he listed in the final settlement.
That's correct. Yes. And he ends up with right around that amount. He asked for about $32,000 and
right.
some change.
Right.
The judge reduced it by $2,500.
The judge obviously wouldn't have given him the other $15,000 if he thought he was stealing money. So what state of mind are we dealing with here? Negligence or...
Well, that's a key issue here as to the baseline sanction. There's no doubt that under the ABA standards that we cite in our brief, that this court needs to decide was respondent acting negligently or knowingly. Our view was that the conduct was knowing under the ABA standards as well as the definition of knowing conduct in the rules. Rule 4-1.0 subsection F says that you can rely on circumstantial evidence. So what is that circumstantial evidence? In our view, he knew about the statute requiring a court approval of fees because he cited that statute in his amended petition for fees in February 2015. The judge cited that statute in awarding him partial fees of $15,000.
What if he'd told the court in mid-July about what had happened and then he'd done this? Would you be asking for the same sanction?
I think it would have mitigated to some extent even further the sanction we might seek, because if he had come forward and said, this was an oversight, I didn't list it in the settlement, I took this fee, then perhaps we'd mitigate. Whether or not it would mitigate off of a suspension, I can't say for sure because it just never happened. But the fact is, he knew on June 25th, 2015, when he took that fee, that the court expected application to be made. The statute required it, and he knew about it because he cited that statute in his request for fees.
So do we have to find that, what if he just totally misread the statute, which is his position, he didn't understand that, and that was negligent on his part? Or do we have to infer anyone reading it would have had to understand it, so he was trying to get something early, and how do we deal with that?
In my view, taking the entire course of conduct from February 2015 through the end of this case, through his involvement in the case, I think there's just a multitude of steps where it indicates at least circumstantial evidence of knowing misconduct.
Well, what about the failure to disclose in June 25th? Doesn't that suggest that he knew about it? I mean, if he was just making a mistake, it would have shown up on the final settlement.
Exactly. I mean, I will say this, the bank records attached to that final settlement referenced his payment to himself, but the settlement, the petition itself, the pleading, failed to notify. It makes no sense to the informant that you would fail or make a mistake and not disclose a payment that you took to yourself in June without court authority, unless you were doing that in a knowing fashion.
Isn't that kind of, I'm just trying to figure out how this works when we don't think he was stealing it, and obviously the court would be aware of it because he wouldn't be taking another $15,000, so it would have to come out at some point. The whole series of events
he wasn't
is confusing.
Stealing it, but I think it was deceitful towards the court, Judge Smith.
Was there anything that addressed him? I mean, the court would have found this out at some point, or looking at the records, they did find out. How could he not know that?
In his brief, he states, I was negligent, but I knew the judge would discover this as soon as he looked at the attachments to the settlement pleading. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that, to me, that just indicates more than negligence. To me, taking the payment initially without court order, knowing that the statute as well as the judge expected it, was more than negligence. It was knowing, it was deceitful. And secondly, not disclosing it on September 1 or even on September 11. On September 1, he files his motion for a final settlement. On September 10, the judge issues an order to show cause why he shouldn't be removed and held in contempt. The very next day, he files his motion for fees, September 11, 2015, and again does not disclose in the pleading that I took this money to myself. That, to me, along with the June 25th payment, indicates more than simple negligence that might warrant something less than a suspension.
But now, respondent says that he took the money to save the state some taxes, which I guess the accountant testified to was a little over $1,000.
Correct, Judge Russell. In what I consider to be an after-the-fact justification for his conduct, he says, I did it because it saved the state taxes. His own accountant said that on June 25th, there was no way to really know what those taxes were. He did end up, the accountant testified that there was just less than $1,400 in state and federal taxes saved because of that that money taken without a court order. Against an estate of almost $1.3 million, I think that's a nominal sum. Secondly, I don't think it justifies violating the statute and the judge's orders simply to attempt to save taxes to the estate. He knew he had this obligation, and he violated that obligation.
Well, and again, he, after the order to show cause, after he met with the judge, he filed the request for fees, and you said he didn't reveal that he'd already paid himself the extra $15,466.
Correct.
I mean, clearly there would be no deception then because the order to show cause had already issued.
I suppose you could look at it that way. The judge obviously already knew he issued an order to show cause. My view would be I better make sure that I disclose this on the next day when I file my motion for fees that, yeah, I took this money on June 25th. I understand what you're saying. I just have a different view of what my how I would view my obligation. I would not, again, fail to make that disclosure after I knew the judge already knew that I had taken that money.
And what and the court held a hearing on this, or how did what do we know
no,
about?
I think the court ended up holding the respondent in contempt. It went up on a writ, and while that writ was pending, Judge Beard withdrew the contempt order. The writ was dismissed as moot. And so yes, I don't believe a hearing was ever held any further for that issue. What the judge ended up doing was reducing the fee by $2,500. The other defenses raised, the respondent called Kenton Askren, a former probate judge, to testify that he could make this payment because it's a claim against the estate. Our view is that statute that Judge Askren and this respondent are relying on is superseded by a more specific statute saying that you don't get personal representative fees unless you make an application to the court. I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. Two acts by respondent over a period of basically 7 months are what are at issue here. The crux of this case, as has been mentioned, is what respondent's mental state was. Was it intent? Was it knowing? So even if he violated a law or court order when he paid himself the remainder of the personal representative fee on June 25th, it wasn't knowing, and here's why. Because although he had practiced probate law for many years, he had only been a personal representative a few times, and then he had never encountered a situation before where he believed there was an immediacy in making that payment so that it wasn't really feasible to wait and go through the court to get authority. Excuse me. He understood, and the state tax return is in error on the time frame of the estate fiscal year. He understood that the fiscal year was going to end on June 29th, and June 25th is when the accountant told him, "You need to get those fees paid before the end of the fiscal year, because there are going to be more taxes if you don't do that." Now, the tax return hadn't been calculated. Respondent didn't know how many taxes. He just knew he had a fiduciary duty to try to reduce the burden on the estate. And so
But the court's order was, and I know you take issue with that, but it seemed pretty clear, and it must have been somewhat clear to him because he did try to contact the judge, but then once he took out the money, he quit attempting. He didn't file anything afterwards, alerting the court to what he'd done and why, and he didn't mention it in the settlement.
Well, here's what happened was he took the money believing that he did not need prior court authority, even though it had been his practice to do that. He hadn't run into a situation previously where he felt there was an immediate need. He did. His testimony is he did for about a week or so try to contact the judge, but we know the judge was out of town, out of state even, on June 25th until for a few days. And then Mr. Gardner testified that he tried several times to go over and see the judge.
Well, why did he go see the judge if he didn't think he needed to?
Because probate is kind of a strange little world, and I think he just felt like he wanted to let the judge know that he had done something that was out of the norm, but not. But he, if he felt like he needed authority, he would have filed something. But he just wanted to inform the judge. And so when he couldn't inform the judge within a reasonable period of time and something else came up that was really consuming his attention, then that dropped by the wayside. So then the explanation for why it was not listed on page 4 of the final settlement is that he had prepared, and this is where he certainly made a mistake, and he has absolutely admitted that he made a mistake by omitting that check. But what had happened was he had prepared the final settlement, but for that check, when he went to see the accountant on June 25th. And then a couple of months later, when he goes to file the final settlement, he simply fails to realize that he did not have that check listed. He did include all of the checks, including that check, in the supporting documentation. He did include the total amount on page 5 in the far right-hand column, which he understood to be amounts that had been paid out of the estate. Now, he and Judge Beard apparently have a different understanding of what it means to put something in the far right-hand column, but that was respondent's understanding, was that he was putting that in the far right-hand column, indicating that it had been paid. I have seen situations where attorneys were intentionally trying to deceive the court and bank records were involved, and I have seen them omit. He would have omitted
that check.
And that's
why this is not alleged to be intentional or theft. It's alleged to be knowing. So it's an unusual in-between here.
But it's alleged to be deceitful, mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty much an intentional type standard to say that he
deceitfully. Well, there's a difference between deceiving the judge and deceiving the client. Right? There's a difference. So, you know, and I think that's why it's in the middle. He didn't try to convince the client he didn't take the money. He tried to sneak it by the judge that he took it without permission.
Well, we certainly assert he did not try to sneak anything by.
What did the DHP find?
The DHP rubber stamped the OCDC's proposed findings to the point that their decision starts out with, comes now the Office of Chief Disciplinary Counsel. I mean, they just did not do any individualized analysis of the situation. That it actually, you look at it and they just did not change it, even from what the language was of the proposed findings. We do have, on the other hand, people who know the respondent well. We have two circuit judges, or maybe three, affidavits from them who have known the respondent for a long period of time, who submitted affidavits saying that he is an honest person. We have two attorneys who practiced with him saying that he is an honest person. We have the deposition testimony of Judge Askren, who in addition to testifying that he believed that it was not necessary for respondent to get prior approval, and that's important because that means we've got attorneys who believe different things about that statute. Whether it's reasonable or not, we've got good faith belief on the part of multiple attorneys that this statute did not require prior authority. And then we've additionally got Judge Askren, who has known respondent for a long period of time, testifying that he is an honest person. Everybody who knows him says, you know, that testified in the case, even Judge Beard volunteered that he's a good man and he does a lot for his community, although there was an attempt to dissuade him from saying that off the record. So what we've got here is sloppiness. The first order that Judge Beard entered on February 18th, Judge Beard expressly testified that the second order reversed that first order. The first order said, I'm not going to give you a partial fee, and here's why. The second order said, okay, here's a partial fee. There's no reason to think that the first order still had any credence whatsoever. Now, there were a couple of reasons why he denied the first order, but his own testimony, he says, I reversed the first order when I issued the second order. He also says that if respondent had filed the final settlement within a relatively short period of time, he mentions a week or so after the payment of June 25th, that would have been okay with him. He doesn't look to see if the payment has already been made. That flies in the face of this idea that it's absolutely required to get the authority from the court before you make that payment.
Now, was this supervised administration?
Yes, it was supervised administration.
As opposed to independent.
Correct.
And supervised means what?
Well, supervised means he did have to file all of these documents and submit the final settlement, and the court was going to go through and do all that audit that
doesn't
it ultimately
need court
did.
Approval for certain things, but...
And I will say that certainly he knew about that statute, but did he go and look at that statute under these circumstances? No, because he thought there was basically an emergency situation to just go ahead and get that money out of the estate. He believed that he was going to get the estate, the final settlement filed within a short period of time after he made that payment to himself. That was his testimony. But other things came up and caused him to not do that. So if there are a couple of things that he did, one was not going ahead and getting the estate, the final settlement filed as quickly as he intended to. And then the other was just the forgetting that he had made one more check after he had prepared that draft of the final settlement back in June June 25th. So what we've got here is negligence. I don't believe negligence is what the OCDC has alleged in the rules that it has alleged, but to the extent that you do find that that negligence falls within some of those rules, a low-level discipline, certainly not a suspension, would be appropriate. This is an honest person who made a decision that perhaps in hindsight was not a good decision to just go ahead and immediately make that payment. There's a question whether he would have been able to get it before Judge Beard, before the 29th of June, which is what he believed was the closing date for the estate's fiscal year. But he should have tried, and he should have tried to get another judge, as we look at it in hindsight. But you need to really put yourselves in his position at the time in determining how to discipline him or whether to discipline him. And at the time, this was a situation he had never encountered before with this kind of what he felt like was an emergency. He knew the statute because he cites it all the time when he files his motions, but he didn't go look at the statute, which he should have. And I think that, although I certainly haven't practiced probate law for any time at all, I think he probably would have taken a different approach had he gone and actually looked at the statute at that point. But just the fact, you know, we all cite things that we think we know all the time and don't always go back and read them every time. So he didn't do that. He just went ahead and paid himself because he thought that that was okay to do. He thought it was for three reasons. He thought as PR, rather than attorney, his normal role, that he could go ahead and do that. He thought that the will itself gave him the authority to do that. And he thought that because he was...
Did this will authorize independent administration?
I'm sorry?
Did this will authorize independent administration?
No, it was the authority that the will said about what the personal representative could do, but it did not say, I don't believe it's in the record, but no, it didn't say specifically anything about independent is authorized. But so what we've got are these two situations. One, he should have gone and looked at the statute. He should have thought about it more carefully and tried to get court authority. Then he should have followed through with what he intended to do, which was very soon afterwards get the final settlement filed. And then certainly, and this is the one that where he absolutely clearly, you know, made a mistake, and he testified that and acknowledged that at the hearing, And acknowledged that to Judge Beard when Judge Beard called him in with the show cause. He made a mistake in failing to put that check on page 4. It should have been right above where it says Edwards Jones, so it would have been under the USB account. It would have been the very last check. It was included. Now, he did not take the approach of, well, I don't have to list this check because I'm including the copy of it with the supporting documents and I'm including the bank statement in the supporting documents. Our point to that has been misconstrued by informant. Our point to that is it would have been just really stupid for him to be trying to deceive the court by leaving it off the final settlement sheet and thinking the court wouldn't find it, and then going ahead and submitting the check to the court with the bank records. Even if he'd been trying to deceive the court, I believe he would have at least omitted the check itself from the supporting documents. But I certainly have seen lawyers who have altered bank statements in very believable ways to not show things or to show different things than they should show. If he were doing that, that's would be deceit.
The chief disciplinary counsel argues that probation is not appropriate because your client has not acknowledged the wrongfulness of his act.
Well, what he has said is that he believed at the time that writing the check to himself without prior authority was permissible. Now, I guarantee you, if he encounters that situation again, he will seek prior court authority. He has absolutely acknowledged the wrongfulness of his act in negligently failing to list that check on the final settlement. The words he used were screwed up during the hearing. I mean, that's, to me, is an acknowledgement that you've done something wrong. So we're not saying that if he had it to do over again, that he should do it the same way or that it would be fine to do it the same way. What we're saying...
I do see on the settlement that no activity occurred after June 25. That was the last thing.
Yes, that would have been the very last entry, and so everything else had already happened by June 25th.
Is there any reason the final settlement wasn't filed sooner other than this other case came up?
The other case came up within like a week or so. I mean, it was set for trial, so we all know that that means he's going to have to be ramping up and preparing for this big trial. So, thank you.
I think your client has something he wants. But you have rebuttal.
Oh, and he also had to get waivers from the clients or from the beneficiaries.
Let's be clear about what just got said. What was just said is that it was negligent not to list that check in the final settlement. No reference to the fact that on June 25th he took the payment against the judge's orders, against statutory authority, and against his own knowledge of what was required. That was the deceit against the court in violation of 8.4C. The failure to list it on the settlement is just an indication of state of mind in our view.
But I think, to be fair, what counsel just said is that on the 25th, he rightly or wrongly thought it was okay. Since that time, he's realized he won't do that, but it doesn't change what his state of mind was at the time. He can't acknowledge he thought something different than he thought.
Well, but at the hearing, if you look at the testimony, if you read the brief, it's all after the fact justification for what he did. Calling Mr. Askren, not having talked to Mr. Askren prior to June 25th,
right,
but when the hearing came about, I'm calling Mr. Askren. He's going to support the fact that these were payments I could make because they're claims against the estate. That's not what I heard today. Oh, he made a mistake. What he was saying at the hearing was I was allowed to take that payment on June 25 because it was a claim that I had against the estate. Clearly not what the law is. The law is this is a supervised estate. You have to apply to the court for your fees. And he did not do that. And to me, that's additional evidence of knowledge. I need to bring up the Charon case because I think that supports suspension here as well. Charon involved an attorney who failed to file an annual estate settlement and who paid himself personal representative fees and other monies without a court order. And in that case, Judge Limbaugh found that the attorney, Charon, was entitled to the money, but because he didn't ask for a court order approving the fee, he gets suspended for a year. I think it supports the fact that in this case, a suspension of 6 months, indefinite suspension with leave to apply in 6 months, is appropriate. The disciplinary hearing panel's adoption of our findings. There's nothing wrong with adopting the findings of a party, even verbatim, under controlling Missouri law.
Well, you are supposed to not say what they said at the top. I mean, it does indicate, the cases say it's fine unless there's some indication of a lack of independent judgment. So I think that's their argument.
And what I will tell you is if you do a careful study, as I did, of the proposed findings along with the DHP's findings, there's about 25 places where there are changes,
okay.
Minute changes, but changes of either little substance or some substance from what we submitted to what ended up being filed. I agree. It shouldn't have said come now, inform it. Nevertheless, the controlling case law in Missouri, as you mentioned, Judge Stith, would allow that to occur. I think Chief Justice Fisher hit it on the head. This is not deceiving the client. This is deceiving the court on June 25th with that payment. We're asking for an indefinite suspension with no leave to apply for reinstatement for 6 months. Thank you.
Thank you.